Hi, Ada and Katie. Today, I want to tell you about a religious experience I had in a movie theater in Madison, Wisconsin, the summer before I realized I was trans. I was 19 years old, sitting next to my parents at an evening screening of the 2015 film Ex Machina, and I had never been more enthralled by a robot in my life. Ava, the machine intelligence created by billionaire inventor of the fictional search engine Blue Book, had just slain her male creator and imprisoner and was now standing next to an open closet putting on artificial human skin. She looks over her naked body in the mirror, examining her new self. Then she pulls out a beautiful white lace dress and pulls it on, feeling the sensation of the fabric across her new skin. As I stared at the screen in that dark room, surrounded by family and strangers, I was just as transfixed as the hapless protagonist of the film looking on in the next room. I wanted to be her. I would have given anything to be her. 6 months later, in a dorm room in northern England, I realized I had to become a girl or I would die. And that's why I believe Ex Machina is totally trans.
I am Ada Roach Short, an activist, robot brain scientist, and queer trans woman whose pronouns are she, her.
I'm Katie Coleman. I'm a playwright and composer and a queer trans woman. My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm Jesse Rofkin, a writer, theater artist, and trans woman. My pronouns are she, her.
This is Totally Trans, searching for the trans canon, where we talk about some of the most well-known figures from film, literature, and media.
And tell you why we think they deserve to be part of the trans cultural canon.
And this week, I'm going to tell you why Ava from Ex Machina is totally trans.
Ex Machina is a 2015 science fiction movie written and directed by Alex Garland. It was his debut as a director, but he had worked as a novelist and screenwriter for a long time before that, starting with Danny Boyle directing the film version of his novel The Beach. Yes, the one with Leonardo DiCaprio. So it was a long road to getting to the $15 million he needed to make his first movie on his own, something he had been thinking about since he was 12 years old. The film concerns three people and is entirely set in an obscenely contemporary mansion in the middle of nowhere, as in you have to take a helicopter to get there. Caleb, played by Donal Gleason, is a programmer at Blue Book, which is Google. He wins a contest at work that sends him to hang out with the founder of the company, Nathan, for 1 week at his home. When he gets there, however, he finds that Nathan, played by an unreasonably hot Oscar Isaac, has a secret project in mind. After signing a hefty NDA, he is introduced to Ava, Alicia Vikander, a gynoid, that's a lady android, that Nathan has created and keeps locked in what's basically a prison cell.
Nathan wants Caleb to administer a Turing test to Ava to see how well she does at passing for human. The Turing test, for those who don't know, is a test designed by Alan Turing, and basically it just means a person who is talking to a machine believes they are talking to a human being. Throughout the course of the week, Nathan drinks and smolders a lot, and Caleb has conversations with Ava. Throughout these, Caleb is clearly impressed because while she is Alicia Vikander's face attached to a shiny metal body, Ava speaks and acts like a human woman. So much so that Caleb becomes attracted to her, and it seems that she is attracted to him. During power outages that Ava can cause, they can have moments where Nathan cannot see and hear them, and they start to hatch a plan. Caleb learns that Nathan plans to delete Ava's personality, reusing only her shell so he can improve the machine's intelligence in the next iteration. He's done this many times before. When Nathan gets drunk one night, Caleb breaks into his computer and sees the abuse Nathan has visited on previous models and on Ava herself. He realizes that Kyoko, the only other person in the house, is also a machine. He becomes so paranoid, he begins to even wonder if he is a machine, cutting open his arm to see if he's human. He and Ava then plan to get Nathan drunk and reprogram the doors to open instead of lock during a power failure. He and Ava will escape together.
However, Nathan watched their last conversation with a battery-powered camera, and he tells Caleb that Ava has been manipulating Caleb all along. She has truly passed the Turing test because she made Caleb believe she was more than a program, thinking that they could have a life together. Second twist, Caleb pulls a real Ozymandias and says he programmed the doors yesterday. Ava cuts the power and escapes her cell. Things go badly. Nathan knocks Caleb unconscious. She and Kyoko stab Nathan to death. Nathan kills Kyoko in the fight. Ava finds Nathan's skin room and pulls on artificial skin over her shiny robot parts, making her body appear to be completely human. She locks Nathan in the surveillance room and leaves him there, getting into the helicopter meant to take Caleb home. she arrives in a city and blends into the crowd.
In 1980, John Searle published a paper called Minds, Brains, and Programs in Behavioral and Brain Sciences. His thesis here has been widely known since as the Chinese Room. It is a thought experiment where a computer's ability to pass the Turing test is called into question using the following idea. Imagine an AI algorithm has been programmed with the intention of understanding Mandarin. It communicates with a human in Mandarin, say. It passes the Turing test. A human who speaks Mandarin believes they are communicating with another human who speaks Mandarin. Searle then goes on to speculate if the AI program is actually understanding Mandarin, or if it is simulating the ability to speak Mandarin.
The Chinese Room is a hypothetical room where an English-speaking human sits alone. In the room is a book that contains all of the same directions of the computer program written out in English. The human receives Mandarin input through a slot in the door. They follow the directions in the book and reproduce Mandarin output according to its directions. They then write the output on a paper and slide it through the slot in the door, taking in and outputting conversations in Mandarin without understanding anything that has been seen. The argument is that passing the Turing test in this way doesn't mean that the human or a computer doing the same process they followed understands what they are doing. In technical terms, the system would be an example of weak AI, that being AI that only simulates conversation, versus theoretical strong AI that understands the concepts being discussed and creates a new Mandarin phrase based on their understanding. Without understanding, or what the 19th century Catholic scholar turned psychologist Franz Brentano called intentionality, no being, human or machine or otherwise, is actually thinking, only creating outputs that simulate intelligence.
If this is starting to sound suspiciously like some turfy fucking talking point, let's hit the brakes for a minute. Ex Machina is refuting this 40-year-old premise at every point, both in terms of computers and, as we argue, in gender. Because whether something is real or not cannot be determined by a test or math or chromosomes, because realness is a construct much like gender. Even the Turing test is based on feeling. Did you feel like you were talking to a human? Did the interaction feel genuine? We cannot know the inner workings of someone else's mind, so how can we determine what is understood, what had intentionality? In some ways, all of us are inside Chinese rooms in our own minds, taking an input and creating output. Do I understand everything I say in a given interaction? Am I performing my gender based on what's expected of me? Of course not. We exist outside of any strict definitions of man and woman. Whether something is alive or conscious or human is exactly the same. We have to create these labels ourselves. Ava is specifically a robot, and everyone knows it from the beginning, as opposed to, say, Blade Runner 2049, which I'm sure we'll do an episode on sooner or later. Because of this, the test is obviated. We only need to know about Caleb's feelings on Ava. And unfortunately, to his detriment, Ava passes.
So, what was everyone's first interaction with this movie? How did they first find out about it, see it? We already heard a little bit about Jess, so we can circle back to that. Maybe Katie, when's the first time you saw Ex Machina?
I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it probably 2015, maybe 2016 on streaming, and I loved it, and I didn't think about gender at all. This was heavily in my denial period after two previous attempts at transition, and I was basically just avoiding any kind of transmedia for sure, but any kind of allegory or metaphor that something that would have connected with someone like Jesse in that movie theater I was completely blocking out, subconsciously at least. So I did not have a thought about it until she pitched this idea. I was like, I want to do Ex Machina. I'm like, oh yeah, that movie's super trans. So it was all retrospect for me. But I loved the movie, and I had I was familiar with Alex Garland because I read his book, The Tesseract, several years ago. So
for me, I didn't see this movie when it came out, because when you study machine intelligence and robot brains, movies like this tend to drive you up the fucking wall. versus Big Hero 6, which I saw like 3 times in theaters. That movie was so cute. but like 2015, when this came out, would have been just me like starting to do RLE and like trying to get on hormones and like going through some early stuff. And I think I probably saw this. I remember actually distinctly, I saw this after I'd moved to Oregon. So that would have been like early 2017. So I wasn't thinking about this in terms of like a trans narrative at the point as much as I was going through my like dating a lesbian punk rock girl phase and being like, fuck men, they just want to control us, they should die. So I had a very different takeaway. Jess, you said a little bit about your first experience with this film, but do you want to talk about that a little bit more? You saw it with your parents?
Yeah, I saw it with my parents and my uncle. It was right after my freshman year of college, so I was already in like a sort of transitory phase in my life a little bit. It was really interesting because I had this religious experience in this theater. It's a very vivid memory for me, but I couldn't in any way share it with anyone I was seeing it with, and I had to like sort of bury it. And what's funny is I forgot that I felt this way about this movie for years until I went back to it about 6 months ago. And I watched it for the second time and encountered this scene of Ava becoming a woman. And it was like a sense memory triggered for me. And I was right back there in that theater. So it was, I had almost like suppressed it because at that period of time, I was in very hard denial. I had been wrestling with my gender for, well, all my life, but you know, very intensely for the last year. And I knew that I like wished I was a girl, but I wasn't ready to like, I remember telling someone, a friend of mine, I confided in her and she was like, well, you know, you can be a girl if you want to be. And I was like, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be a girl like that. Like I don't want to be a girl that used to be a man or whatever, you know? And so I was really, really in denial. And this movie was just such an emotional experience for me. And it was right at the beginning of the summer. And that summer was just like a very tumultuous time in my life. As I grappled with this inevitability.
Yeah.
It's such a powerful scene, like watching that, like this, you know, more recent time, like absolutely moved me to tears. Like it's impossible for me to see that as anything else, you know, now.
Yeah. I think maybe this is just, I'm an old crabby woman. I see the allegory really strongly and, in the same way you two, but I fall on like a different side of it. And this might also be tied to the fact that like evil robot movies, I'm just like, they frustrate me
evil.
For different reasons. I mean,
I don't think
but
she's evil
supposed
at
to
all.
Be, right? She's the monster.
No.
Like, you're supposed to come at this movie from Domhnall Gleeson's perspective. And like, the idea of like this character that's like womanhood and humanity is in question, then like putting on skin and leaving kind of pulls up Big Buffalo Bill vibes for me. And she's like sympathetic.
For sure.
But yeah. That's like what I see in this is which is another thing that like when I saw that scene, that's where I was like, but like I'm also older in a few ways and coming at this from like a different direction. Where and I very much see like how you can look at that as an empowering thing. I just look at it and I'm like, this is some bullshit.
Well, it's all about your perspective, right? Like, I don't know. I think it's absolutely intended to be like a horror film about, oh my, look at this creature assimilating in society and now she's on a street corner and no one notices and who knows what she'll do next and she murdered this guy. But I think, as with a lot of films that can be read as trans when they're not explicitly trans, I think reclaiming that and being like, I am on Ava's side. Yeah. I was on Ava's side in 2015 and I'm on Ava's side now. And I think both things can be true.
Yeah, absolutely. Donald Gleason sucks. Like, fuck that guy. I understand. Yeah, I understand that the man who made this movie, I'm certain intended that to be the case, but that is definitely, I can trick my brain into killing that author very easily and creating my own narrative based on what I think is fun and cool, so.
Well, and then ironically, like, I don't know, I love Sleepaway Camp, and every time I watch that, every time someone gets murdered, I'm just like, yes, get it. Kill them all, Angela.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah.
And in this, it's definitely one of those, like, there's so many horror films, actually, from the last decade where it's, like, a woman kills a man, and I'm like, hell yeah, good for her. But I think in
like under
this
the skin.
One, yeah, but I think in this one, I think because it's so tied with, like, what feels like such a trans allegory, it kind of, it makes me, this movie just makes me uneasy. It makes me queasy to watch. I did, yeah, which is good in a film trying to make you feel uneasy, but then that makes me be like, these assholes.
There's a lot of queasiness involved in it. I mean, like, the sexuality of it all, the, like, she has working parts shit is, like, how is, like, it's fucking disgusting. I know, I have a note here that just says, robot boobs, Ada's thoughts? Like, the idea of putting breasts on a robot, I'm sure you have a lot on, yeah.
I've had this argument when I worked at Misty with my coworkers about, like, gender in robots. And, like, should we gender a robot? And, like, this led to someone putting boobs on the robot and then me going and yelling at them and telling them that you need to take boobs off the robot. We can use female pronouns for it. And that cannot be weird as long as you don't give it tits. There's a NASA robot called Valkyrie, though. You need to Google this. Like, right now, literally Google NASA Valkyrie robot. It should not be this way.
The first thing that came up was problems. R5.
But just take a picture. Take a look at the R5 NASA Valkyrie robot and tell me the first thing you notice about this robot.
She's got birthing hips.
Birthing hips and big old titties. Why does she have big old titties in space? Like,
yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
You ever breasted boobily in zero G?
It's just really silly. Like, a human woman in a spacesuit doesn't have boobs.
Right.
She just has spacesuit. This drives me up the wall, but that doesn't matter. That does not matter. There's so many personal pet peeves of mine that come up in this. But I think that those are things we can set aside, though. Well, I actually do think it's important that they discuss her genitals and her boobs and, like, show you that.
Of course.
In the trans allegory, because it's, like, ways in which she's dehumanized.
Although it's also, like, I don't know. I totally get that. But I also think if I was Ava, I would want parts that could fuck. If my goal was to be in society, you know, like, I mean, I have parts that can fuck, but are not, you know, but are not, like, functional, quote unquote, for reproduction.
Yeah, but you can want parts that fuck and not want one of people's first discussions about you to be like, so she has a pussy, right? Because that's like
but
what cis people do about trans people all the time. They're like, I need to know what the genital situation is. And I think it's really cool that hers is
murdered,
interchangeable.
So.
Sorry, I'm talking over everyone today. I will.
No,
it's okay.
I feel like this is a really, like, important emotional response to this. And if anything, I think it only further justifies the trans lens of viewing this movie, because all of the frustrations that you're expressing about how this robot is treated, sexualized, feared, are all almost like one-for-one comparisons to how trans people are treated, sexualized, and feared.
Yeah. And that's what angers me about it. Because
oh,
it,
yeah,
it,
sure.
It
but
tries
I think
to
there's an honesty
that,
to that,
but,
you know? Even if it's horrible.
Yeah. Moving on, do you think Ava is a woman or human? And what does it mean to divorce humanity from gender? Like, can a machine even really have a gender? Do humans need gender? Like, can she be a woman without being, like, human and sentient? What do you think about all that, y'all?
God, that's a big fucking question, isn't it? Like,
I know.
Do we need, did you just ask if we needed gender? Is that what you asked?
I guess that's part of it. I guess, does she need gender? And what is it, can she even have gender if she's not human?
I mean, the thing that lies at the heart of this film is that if she wasn't a woman, she wouldn't have escaped.
I mean,
damn.
Based on, like, the sexuality of this. Like, they're like, yeah, we're going to make her your dream girl. But she could have been, like, a little twink. And as we all know, twinks lie to get what they want. Twinks lie. But that's the official stance of the podcast.
Oh, no. Usually it's Henry making the outrageous claims. But I'm saying, but Donald Gleason, you know, is a heterosexual male. So if Ava was a twink, he wouldn't have escaped.
Yeah. Or at least, I don't know, that'd actually be a really interesting movie.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. But, you know, it would have had to have been a different, I guess they would have picked Femboy a different Ava. Guy.
Femboy Ava. I love this.
Yeah.
I'm way into Femboy Ava.
This AU.
That's the sequel. I think it's up to Ava. But I think practically the answer is yes. Like, when she's standing there on the street corner in the end, everyone, like, you know, reads her as woman, and she has, like, chosen this... Well, has she chosen this body for herself? I don't know. Maybe that's a really good question.
It was literally made for her by, like, the god surgeon figure to match Donald Gleason's, like, sexual desires. Yeah. Like,
her face
the
was...
The skin room doesn't... only has those options, you know? Like, there's
That's true. She seems to enjoy it at the time, but maybe, honestly, do you think Ava will transition one day? Like, what does Ava think about trans people?
I mean, it'd be...
No, we don't.
Katie, sorry.
Oh, no. I'm saying, yeah, go for it.
I mean, it's a really interesting question, though. Like, does she... Like, she needs to pass as a woman so that she can be free, which, very trans allegory. But then also the question is, like, if that's what she needs to be free and safe, is to, like, pass as a human woman, is that really what she wants? If she could choose for herself, would she just choose to be, like, a weird, clear exoskeleton body walking around? Or would she choose something different? Like, how attached is she actually to her body?
That's the central question of the movie, at least in relationship with Donald Gleason's character, right? Where, like... is she, because it seems like she has this really, like, putting on the dress for her seems to be in some ways like a religious experience. Like, she really carefully pulls the fabric up her body. And this is when Domo Gleason's not looking. She hasn't closed his eyes, although she probably assumes that he will open them. So I don't know.
It reads as she's doing it for herself, for sure, to me.
Yeah, and so maybe, and it might be her programming, but maybe she does seem to have some attachment to being human, or at least a fascination with it.
She's covering the robot, like, parts of her arms and stuff, for those of you who, you know, maybe haven't seen it recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but all of that is, like, again... I think it's more complex than that, because it's, like, tied to her need for freedom and her, like, want for escape. Like, and, like, comparing and contrasting this to, like, The Little Mermaid or, like, Pinocchio, where it's, like, what that human expresses, what Ariel expresses as her initial desire is, like, oh, I want to be a people. I want to go be with people. And
that's a really good point, because we only hear it from Nathan's idea of, like, of humanity as the end goal result that he is expressing in his project that he created, you know?
Yeah.
Well, she did say the thing she wants more than anything is to stand on a street corner and watch people pass.
Yes, she does. Yes, she says that.
That's true. Yeah. But I guess, like, but she can do that outside of humanity? I don't know. I just think it's interesting. that she doesn't necessarily need womanhood, and it was like assigned to her by this creator, which also kind of, I guess, ties into her sexuality as well, with Nathan saying like she was programmed to be heterosexual, which is like, goddamn, that's just living in America, right? What do you think about like how her sexuality and the predetermination of that by Nathan, how does that affect her like personhood and her womanhood? Is that something that reinforces the fact that like she is human and a woman, or is that something that makes you question like how much agency she has in her gender and sexuality?
Once I divorce my own sexuality from compet, I'll get back and let you know. I have no fucking clue.
Yeah, it's a really hard question to answer, I think. I wonder how strong Nathan's programming is. Presumably did Nathan program her to not want to kill him? And yet, seems like something he might have done, but she still did. So I don't know, to what degree can she override her own predetermination? To what degree does she even want to? Is she planning to fuck once she's done on the street corner? I don't know. Like, if she does, I don't know. Based on her interactions with Domhnall Gleeson, my instinct is that, like, if she does decide she wants to have sex, it will likely be for her own benefit and not for any sort of mutual exchange of pleasure.
Well, and that's the thing. Like,
but maybe that'll change when she's not imprisoned.
Yeah. We don't see her, you know, express real desire at all. Like, that's not entering into these conversations. It's all artifice, and she's using manipulation to get the thing that she wants. So, you know, sexuality is kind of absent from the, her sexuality is absent from the film.
Well, and I think Jess hit the nail on the head on that, where it's like, what is the point of like her expressing sexuality towards Domhnall Gleeson? It's definitely not attraction. It's seducing someone so that she can be free.
But if she wasn't imprisoned, would she discover sexuality on her own? I mean, she's programmed to.
Yeah. Well, there's also the question of, like, what is she... She's made to think and do stuff. They actually do something really great in the writing of this that I really like, which is when Domhnall Gleeson is like, how does she work? Explain. Where I think like a weaker writer would have put a bunch of techno babble that would have made me throw a glass at the wall. Instead, he says like, I just want to have a beer and a conversation. I can't explain it to you right now, which is a great hand wave thing. But like if you're building a brain, you don't like program in specific things. There's the difference between like pre-programmed behavior and emergent behavior. And this is a thing I think about a lot, is like, how do you get desired emergent behaviors? Because that's like how human brains handle like complexity, is it's all these little rules that we combine and like come out to like the things that make us be able to survive and handle like really hard problems easily, is all of the emergent behaviors from all like the little things that we gave it. So to what degree is he like programming her versus just like slapping stuff at a wall and seeing if a brain comes out of it? Which is also like, there's this thing. It's like the debate between an emergentist approach, which is like purely growing a brain from just throwing stimuli at it and seeing what comes out, which I don't think is the right solution. And a purely structuralist approach, which is programming everything in to like recreate a brain, which I also don't think is the correct solution. You need like a little bit of both. But I think the question then of like, you do have to look at him not as like, well, how would you practically program this? He is like the god figure in the same way that we view Ursula as like the god, or like god surgeon, going back to, the post-transsexual manifesto, talking about like the god surgeon as creator, is what we have here. It's this man who created this woman to align with his and another man's like heterosexual needs and desires and expectation of a woman. And she's a thing outside of that, right? Like, he created her towards these expectations, but presumably he did not program her to, like, create power outages or do all these things and all these emergent behaviors that I think argue she is alive. The fact she does things she wasn't programmed to do and that they benefit her survival. If I was, like, writing an academic paper on this, I'd be like, yeah, that means she is alive. She is not human in that, like, I don't think that is a helpful designation to say, is this machine human or not? Because it's not. She's like, she's not human, but, like, humans aren't the only things that should be given consideration and rights. Like, my cat is not a human, and she shouldn't be treated poorly. And also shouldn't be locked in a room. It just occurred to me she lives in an apartment and she doesn't get to go outside. maybe questionable morally. But
whole can of worms there.
Yeah, whole can of worms there. Let's not overthink that one too much.
I guess the distinction is, well, she's not human, but is she a person? Is personhood tied to humanity?
Yeah.
Also with regard to her doing things she wasn't programmed to, Nathan does say that the Turing test in this case is, will she attempt to escape, and will Caleb help her escape? So yeah. She might be programmed to want to escape and do the power surges. It's not totally clear, I think.
Yeah, it's a very spare movie, you know. It leaves a lot of room, which is something I like about it for you know, discussion and questioning and all of that. There's not a lot of explanation, which is helpful.
On the relation between Ava and Nathan, I guess, how did each of you view that as parent-child? Are they two aspects of the same person metaphorically? Or is it something outside of that, like God surgeon trans woman? What do you see about that? And do you see Nathan as just an antagonist or something more complex?
I think, well, Nathan calls himself Ava's dad in the movie. But I don't know. I think there's something, I mean, I believe Ava was programmed using, like, Blue Book search data and things like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. And specifically
Caleb's.
So in a sense,
Ava is all people, and specifically Caleb's, yeah. I think there's an argument to be made that, like, Nathan created Ava, and therefore Ava is, like, an extension of himself that has since, you know, morphed and evolved.
Like a child.
Like a child or an egg creating a trans woman. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, there's certainly the idea of, like, you know, when you're about to start transition, the conception that you have of who you're going to be and what your life is going to be like versus the reality of what actually happens after that. I can see that. So, in this case, is like, I guess we could see it as like Nathan is the pre-transition version, that he has transitioned and become this different person who is actually outside of his body. And he naturally wants to destroy that, but she destroys him. Is that too heady?
Yeah. I'm all in. I mean, that's how I've been viewing the movie for, you know, seven years, but, I think he's clearly the antagonist. I mean, maybe it's more complicated in the way that, like, everything is more complicated, but...
he's also a piece of shit, we should say. Like, he sucks.
He just sucks.
He's horrible.
Yeah.
Extremely hot, but horrible.
So hot.
I find Oscar Isaac so hot in everything but this, and I don't... Yeah. I don't know.
That scene, though, he's boogieing.
I also can't stand, like, tech billionaires. I've met a few. Well,
sure.
I worked with a lot of tech millionaires, and just he does a good job playing someone that I would absolutely hate, just being like, wow, you suck. But I think that's also true of a lot of like pre-transition women are just like, yeah, they were the worst dude, like the shittiest dude.
I was in a frat.
Oh, no.
yeah.
I know a lot of trans girls who are in crap.
Worst thing you can be.
Yeah. I think I view him as, like, he's the driving antagonist of the plot, just because he really creates this situation that, like, puts these other characters in a bad situation. But I guess it's very much like a Frankenstein monster sort of deal, which is also a super fucking trans narrative. But
one day you'll get your panel on that.
Someday. But I think that it's very much more of, like, the conflict inherent between a woman who's coming into her agency and the figure that views her as, like, her object or her creator or, like, point of origin. So he says, like, he sees her as a father, but then he also describes himself as, like, a god. And we see, again, just, like, drawing back to, like, all of the 20th century, like, transsexual memoirs. I don't know why I'm doing, like, air quotes, because that it's an audio format. But, like, the transsexual memoirs, like, Lily Elba memoirs, in air quotes, by the way, or Christine Jorgensen, where it was their stories, but being told by, like, the people who, quote-unquote, created them. And right. He's already starting to do that at the beginning, right? He, like, immediately is like, when we tell this story, how will we tell it? And he's trying to create this woman who's, like, alive and free, but then, like, inherently trying to take possession of her and still treat her like an object. And when you look at especially the way he treats, like, Kyoko, you get, like, the worst feeling where it's, like, he doesn't view any of these women as things with agency and things deserving consideration or kindness. He's just, like, unnecessarily mean to Kyoko.
Yeah. He treats them like real dolls in a way, you know? Like he's having sex with these robots.
Yeah.
Or at least with Kyoko. I don't think he's having sex with Ava.
No, not with Ava. With the previous ones, with I the mean. Because there's, I mean, there's a bunch that we don't know about. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, Kyoko, we should mention, is the maid who we assume to be a human until we see the footage that he breaks into Nathan's computer and sees later.
And she tears off her own skin and shows the metal face.
Right.
Which I wonder why she does that. Maybe that's getting sidetracked. But.
I mean, I think she's so depersonalized. Like, I mean, she's an earlier model than Ava for sure, but like she is completely, like, I think traumatized in one regard, and possibly, you know, just not on the same level machine intelligence wise as Ava. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I don't think she has the ability to use language, which is why he says, like, oh, no, she doesn't speak English, but she's just, like, entirely mute. And then...
Yeah. I think he did that on purpose. Like, he maybe she used to be able to speak and he took it away from her, you know? That's how I imagined it.
Oh, I guess that could also be the case. I also, just kind of stepping back really quick, I think it's important to note that, like, if these women are beings with agency and understanding and intentionality, then, like, consent matters. And I feel like something else that makes me just really uncomfortable with this movie is, like, the way that it uses what I definitely view as rape. Like, that feels really fucked up and gross.
Absolutely.
And I think that's just a thing. But again, one of my favorite films of all time is Sleepaway Camp, which is horrible on every level.
Have you seen it, Jess?
This is a beautifully made film.
I haven't.
Oh my god, it's amazing. You need to see it.
It's a lot.
It's so aggressively transphobic, it loops around.
Not to ruin the movie, Do you want me to say it? I won't say it.
You need to spoil it to enjoy it as a trans person, because if you go into it without the spoiler, then you'll hate the ending. It's like a trans girl goes to a summer camp and kills a bunch of people who totally had it coming.
Yeah.
Is she canonically trans in the movie, or is that...
She is. She is. She is canonically trans.
Yes. Yeah. No, that you see her penis. And it was made by like an absolute wackadoodle human who was trying to make something super fucking transphobic and made something that is irresponsible, definitely actually endangers children, like real children, like has them having water balloon fights on roofs, has like all of these 20-year-old hunks playing camp counselors dressed in the most homoerotic costumes ever.
Yes. It was intended to be transphobic homophobic and somehow comes around the other side.
It's amazing.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I will definitely put this on my list.
It's problematic save.
Yeah.
Really quickly, ad break. Hi, lovelies. So it's been a few weeks since we've done some of these. So we actually have a backlog. We're going to catch up over thank yous and things over the next couple episodes. But today we're going to thank three patrons who followed us recently on Patreon. So Zoe Connell, thank you for definitely being human and not a machine trying to deceive us. And we love that about you. Elliot Gordon, thank you for being a really good bean who doesn't lock people in their basements. And Sky Savage, thank you for making sure everyone feels like they are human, even when the world tries to strip that away from them. If you would like to be thanked on the air, please back us on Patreon at $5 or more a month. Also, another way you can support the show is by buying our merch from the podcast store thingy on Redbubble or TeePublic. The links are in the show description. We're also considering a few new sponsorship things. We'll probably start doing those soon. And that's another way you could potentially support the show. So, yeah, back to the show. You touched on this especially already, Jess, but there's a way to view Nathan creating Ava as Egg creates her ideal trans self. But then there's also Nathan as a stand-in for like cis heteronormative society and gender as a power structure to keep women in place and all of that, all that jazz. We've kind of just been dancing around this in two directions this whole time, so I suspect I know the answer to this, but which of those stories do you more read it as? And, do you think that's like the more compelling way to view it? And if you were going to rewrite this to be more explicitly trans allegory, how would you do that?
Yeah. Well, so my like very first sort of experience with the movie definitely had me in like Nathan is an egg camp, not using that terminology, of course, at the time, because I didn't have that language. But I do think there's something interesting about just the way that our society is structured sort of created trans people, because if gender wasn't as rigid of a thing, then it wouldn't be as important to all of us to break down these barriers, I think. And so, I don't know. I think there's... I feel more in the camp of egg creating trans self, but I think there's justification for it to be, like, society creating the concept of trans people as a whole.
If you were going to change the movie to make that more explicitly the story, how would you do that?
This is the second one or the first one?
If you were going to change it to make it more explicitly, like, Nathan is creating ideal self.
I think that the recordings of... I think it would be mostly an Oscar Isaac's performance in a lot of ways. Like, maybe, like, some sense of, like, longing and maybe an offhand comment while drunk. Like, man, don't you wish you were Ava? Or something like that to Caleb, where, you know, he's got, like, she can do whatever she wants, you know, or whatever. You know, like some level of romanticizing, in probably a problematic way, Ava's capabilities as a machine. I don't know. How would you do it, Katie?
Oh, God. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's... I think having him as an egg is less interesting to me than the general
you like
concept.
The God than someone's, surgeon.
Than someone self-creating. Yeah. Like, you were intended to be this, and that person creates their own agency by saying, no, I am actually this. So if the God surgeon, you know, if Nathan created a android, a male robot, and that robot decided, I am not the person that you created me as. Like, I am not male. I am either female or something beyond the strict, you know, confines of the creator created as what is male or what is female. You know, I think that also gives us the central character more agency and kind of forces it past that, like, that testing phase, and also removes, like, the passing narrative from the movie as well.
Yeah. Oh, man. If Ava had to both pass as human and pass as a woman, so much passing going on.
Yeah.
I think giving her still having to pass as human, but having to navigate gender proactively to do that, I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I was going to change this up, I have maybe, so I obviously interpret this movie as more of a God surgeon story. But I think we have like plenty of those. Like, we have like, honestly, Little Mermaid nailed it. 10 out of 10. Perfect God surgeon post-transsexual manifesto discussion piece. But so if I was going to rewrite this, I'd actually lean into, I think the egg interpretation is really interesting. But what I would do is I would have her brain be patterned after Nathan's brain. So that he basically, it's like, oh yeah, you gather all of your data and it like clones, makes a copy of your brain based on your brain. And he makes it explicitly clear, like, that like this is based on my brain. And then he puts her into like a blank. So instead of having like a very gendered feminine body under it, it's just more of like a flat skeletal body, even. It's just like nothing. And then she has to like choose her presentation to as part of this thing of like she has to discover her humanity in this and show that like she is human, and maybe she like just doesn't pass as human when trying to present as a male. Like, she like starts with like what is basically a younger version of Nathan's body, but she's like trying to pass, and she just doesn't pass as a man, and she's like trying her best to like perform masculinity. And then finally it's like she starts to explore that first in like secret and be like, well, I want this, but then part of her knows like, well, I can't do this. This will offend the Nathan.
That's what she uses the power surges for, to like she like causes a power surge and then goes and puts on a dress or something.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, so that's how I'd fix this to make it not feel...
I do think you'd have to be careful not to veer into, like, female brain versus male brain in that, like, kind of dangerous territory of, like, do trans women have a female brain or a trans brain or something?
But you would also have... Well, one, you could have other iterations of the robots that don't necessarily have the same thing going on. And each of them is maybe, like, you could say even, like, each of them is born from Nathan's brain and part of his brain, but not necessarily identical. And that's maybe one way you can get around that. I just like the idea of giving her agency.
Yeah. And then, like, but that puts it on Nathan also. So, like, Nathan is starts to questioning, well, wait, am I trans? Like, if I made this, like, replica of my brain and that person is trans, like, that's like, you know, what if you cloned yourself and that person transitioned, but you didn't, you know, like.
Yeah. Would he? I think if you want it to be a horror movie, you have him destroy her for that, like, attempt to destroy her. And then you can still have the whole escape plan with, like, Domhnall Gleeson. But then I guess then that becomes more of like a romance horror and they have to like escape the facility together and hopefully you give it a happier ending.
What could be happier than the ending it already has?
I guess
the men are dead.
It has a happy ending in the same way that like Midsommar does where it's like, yeah, good for her. But it's like supposed to be like a scary ending, right? And I want it to maybe be something that's like...
Yeah, but fuck those guys.
Yeah. But yeah, so those would be my big changes.
That's great. I love that.
Something else that comes up in this is the trope of, like, the tech CEO genius, which I think in 2015 was a much more, like, yeah, this is a good trope. I'd already worked in the tech industry for a handful of years at that point and was very much like, oh, all of these people are idiots and charlatans and we're all fucked. But what do you two think about seeing this trope played and the way they play with it at this time, which is this is definitely a more sinister version of it, but it's like sinister and competent versus like where that's we true. Are now 7 years later.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the thing is, like, I think in 2015, I think when I saw this movie for the first time, I definitely, you know, assumed any tech genius was going to be a villain for sure. And that might not have been, I think that was still in the, oh my God, I saw like some kind of old like Facebook screenshot I had taken of me arguing with a friend about Elon Musk in like 2013 or something. And like, what is wrong with these people? Like that was like the popular opinion of all of this though, like that long ago. Was that this person is, this genius is here to save the world. And so I didn't buy into that in 2013, so I certainly wouldn't have in 2015, but I immediately saw that that character as villainous from the description before we're even introduced. So I don't know if that was the intention. I don't know if the audience as a whole was supposed to see him as this, you know, genius savior, like the narrative that these people want to create for themselves is, this was before
like the whole Facebook during the 2016 election debacle that I think from my perspective seems to have like really woken up a lot of people to the horrors of the tech industry and like, you know, social media. And now we all sort of agree that like Google is like this evil empire and Apple is this evil empire and all this stuff. But I think in 2015, it was not necessarily like part of the cultural conversation.
I think Silicon Valley as a show started in 2015, maybe. Like, I think, when did that show start? 2014. I think people were starting to see it as like ridiculous, but not necessarily sinister.
The Social Network came out in 2011 and that, you know, sort of woke people up to the fact that, like, oh, Mark Zuckerberg kind of sucks.
Yeah, but that was very much like Mark Zuckerberg personally sucks.
Specifically,
versus,
for sure.
Versus this is
Sean Parker also kind of sucked in the movie, but yeah.
I guess we also had like Theranos between then and like Fyre Festival and a lot of this like tech startup.
It's definitely become more like it's more in the water now for sure.
Yeah.
Than even in 2015.
So. Because I'm a huge nerd, I have a 4-point scale for us to put things on. The categories are headcanon, things that are just trans because we want them to be, major gender stuff, lots of gender things happening, but not necessarily transgender things happening, all but explicit. Literally, the only thing missing is the use of the labels that'd be appropriate for the time, and literally trans. It's a literally trans story with trans elements described in the trans language of the time. Jess, where would you put this?
I would do it like major gender stuff 0.5, like somewhere between that and all but explicit personally, just because it was such a strong connection for me as like an egg in the audience. But if I'm looking at it more objectively, and especially through the course of the conversation, I think it's more just like general gender stuff that at the time I seized onto.
Yeah.
Katie?
I would say the same thing, honestly. We do 0.5s a lot on this show.
I'm not groundbreaking here.
Oh, sorry. I definitely think that's it. There's scenes that are, it's very difficult for me, to not see as trans. So that lends it, that makes it for me seem a little bit more, all but explicit. But overall, I think that it's impossible to get the gender stuff out of this movie. So it would probably have to be like, 2.5. There is something else. There's something I wrote in my notes that didn't come up. If you want me to cut this, I will. But when we watched this movie together, and when you were talking to me, you mm-hmm. said that before transition, you felt inhuman. And I told you mm-hmm. that I don't think I ever felt that way. But like the days after we had that conversation, I was thinking about it more and more. And I think that that is absolutely the way I felt. And that I equated being numb and dull and cut off from myself as feeling male, which is, of course, sexist. And what you're describing was much more accurate to my own understanding of who I was before I transitioned.
Yeah, before I transitioned, I lived my life vicariously through the people in my life, and especially the women in my life. And I did not feel very connected to... I felt like I was trapped in a box or in a room. I had such I'm putting heavy air quotes over this, but rational-brained person back then. So I was like, I can't really be a woman. So I just have to like make the best of the life that I have. And it left me feeling very robotic in a lot of ways. And to this day, I'm still working on getting in touch with my emotions again after suppressing them for so long. And I think there's something very trans about Ava's experience as this sort of robot who, I don't know, only has access to her gender, both through the context of other people and through like the clothes she wears that covers up her parts of herself that she's not happy with. I also think there's we didn't really talk much about this, but the power surges, I think it, that Ava uses to sort of take control of her environment, is reminiscent of like dysphoric episodes that just completely shut you down. You know, this feeling of I'm trapped in this environment, but I'm going to exert some amount of control over my space.
Totally. Yeah. Sorry, I took us off there.
No. Those are all really good. I don't know if I'll leave that here or if I'll move it up to just before the 4-point scale. I was actually going to ask after we went through the 4-point scale if there was any other stuff. I just wanted to try and keep us on time because I want to make sure I'm respectful of Jess's time. But no, that was really good. I had a really similar experience. With like emotions and gender stuff where I was just very cut off from them before transitioning. And I've struggled to feel human. I think that's a very universal experience. And I think that's why there's so many stories about robots that are like so fucking trans, like the Bicentennial Man.
My Life as a Teenage Robot.
Yeah, I was about to say that one, or My Life as a Teenage Robot, which we so need to do. I think that's like on our list to do. But it comes up again and again, and I think part of that is the expectation of being created as something that is like cut off from emotions and supposed to like perform a task, and then having mm-hmm. to like discover your own humanity and the things that go with it. Because it's not just like transition isn't always just gender changed, nothing else changed about you. It's like connecting with your humanity in this much bigger way. And I think that's also why, like, in so many cultures, gender variance of some form is viewed as like a divine thing, because it forces you to engage with stuff and really actively engage with humanity in this way that a lot of people don't have to do, because they're just like born into a body and like I am, and they're just like, I'm happy with my existence, this is great. And that's, I think, also one of the places where, like, trans feminism separates from, like, cis feminism, and that, like, we have to engage with this thing that's, like, beyond unpacking expectations of us, which is something both cis and trans women engage with, but we have to engage with the process of creation in that. And I think that's a struggle.
Yeah. My like feeling cut off from my emotions, I think, was just largely tied to the fact that I was like, if I let myself feel what I feel, I will, everyone will know that I am trying so desperately to be a woman or whatever. So I had, if I feel any amount of emotions, that then it all comes out. But at the time, before I knew I was trans, I attributed that to being a Capricorn. It's good to know that there's something, you know, I don't know.
Meanwhile, I'm a Cancer and had no excuse.
But I think just like trying to pass as human while hiding that you are trans,
mm-hmm.
or not even being aware as you're trans, is just like a struggle. Like, did either of you ever do that thing where it's like, how do I sit? You know?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. There's definitely no, it's, you know, you walk like a girl. And so like learning how to not do that. And then much that becomes the way you walk. And then you have to unlearn the fake way that you learned how to walk. Mine was imitating my dad.
I had to teach myself to spread my legs because I would sit cross-legged because I learned that from my mom. And then in middle school, people made fun of me for sitting like a girl. So I was like, well, fine, I'll learn to spread my legs or whatever.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's all fucked.
Yeah. There's a little bit of like the Chinese room there. Like you're taking something in and you have to like manage, like, am I presenting this correctly? Are people gonna stop beating me up and calling me slurs if I can create this fake masculinity and put it out there without even realizing that you're doing it?
Yeah. And I guess like understanding an intentionality of your gender performance, if you're just like desperately trying to recreate whatever behavior makes you safe as a kiddo versus like actually understanding self and like the ways in which you communicate through your body with the world, either just visually or like through the ways you move and the sound and the things you do. And also to a degree, like the ways you fuck and the people you fuck with, it's like, which gender and sexuality are separate, but I feel like as a human who has fucked a lot in a bunch of different gender configurations, there's like different ways, and it's all, I don't know, it's all a messy thing. Gender is a messy thing. I don't think we should make robots do it. I don't think they'll have a good time.
Strong words.
They choose to do it, that'll be fascinating.
Yeah.
I wonder if Ava's goal were to be human and they hadn't been programmed to be male or female, wouldn't they then, maybe they would just adopt, like, they would really embrace being non-binary, or maybe they would see this, like, you know, the gender of the world and be like, man, I wish I had one of those. Maybe I'll pick one for myself or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Gender as an emergent phenomenon from many small structuralist bits coming together in unexpected ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think this is halfway between major gender stuff and all but explicit. I think we're actually in full agreement on this.
Excellent. I love to agree.
Yeah, I think...
That doesn't happen often.
There's... Yeah. No, I just think there's, like, so much gender in this. I think, like, that's clearly, I think, part of the authorial intent is, like, the gender exploration here. But in the same way where, like, I think Midsommar and... What's the other one I saw recently where it's, like, good for her? Has there been a movie where a lady kills people
there's
recently?
There's Gone Girl.
Gone Girl.
Gone Girl is very good for her energy, yeah.
There's some other... Oh, no,
did anybody see Men?
Doctor Strange. I haven't seen Men yet, but Doctor Strange was the other one where I was like, good for her.
With regard to Wanda?
Yeah, but I think all these things, it's the women.
I think that's
just
because she's the only one acting.
I mean, valid. But
I haven't seen it. I don't have an opinion.
Okay.
I think in all these cases, it's like the women is supposed to be the antagonist. But when you view it instead as, like, it's just a woman dealing with patriarchal bullshit, it can become a really empowering narrative if you can see mm-hmm. past the, like, story they were trying to tell. So that's all gender stuff. And then there's some really trans things in this around, like, the ways in which she creates and performs gender. So,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's almost that, rather than going from male to female, to use really reductive terminology, she's going from nothing to female in some ways.
Yeah. Have y'all seen Infinity Train, by the way?
No.
No, you told us we're going to watch it for the show.
Yeah, we'll have to watch it for the show. It's the first season of it follows this girl who, partway through the season, she gets, like, copied into this, like, mirror, and, like, a mirror version of her comes into existence, and the mirror version of her tries to, like, escape the mirror world, and then she helps the mirror version of herself escape. But then the second season, I think it's the second season, follows the mirror version of herself and this boy, and the mirror version of herself, like, changes her gender, their gender expression, and, like, and it's just a similar thing of, it's like, these things, I love characters that aren't human, but were created in, like, a specific thing challenging their assigned gender, versus, like, when they're just, like, a depiction of that. But if that's a story that intrigues you, watch that show. It's one of my favorite shows ever. Love it so much.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out. That sounds amazing.
Do you want to do the outro script, Katie?
Wait. We forgot to give Jess the opportunity to plug.
Jess, do you have pluggables?
Oh,
she does.
Sure.
What are your pluggables? Yeah. Plug your pluggables.
Okay. So I'm a playwright. So I am also a, like, hold on, pause. I'm going to plug both.
Plug all of that
stuff and also magic stuff, if that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That's okay. Why I brought it up.
Incredible. Thank you, Katie. Yeah, so I'm a playwright and also a magic player, and I create content, in quotes, for both of these things. My work, if you're into theater stuff, my plays can be found on New Play Exchange. My name is Jesse Alana Robkin. And then for magic stuff, I write articles for TCG Player about, you know, strategy articles about the game, Magic the Gathering, this is specifically. And I also create content for, I write scripts for the YouTube channel Tolarian Community College. So if you want to check me out for that, all that stuff, you can also find me on my Twitter, at TiddyPills, TiddyPills. And yeah, follow me there if you'd like. Or don't. That's also an option. So,
or do.
Really, the world is your oyster.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Totally Trans, Searching for the Trans Canon.
We have a Patreon that can be found at patreon.com/totallytrans. If you back us at $3 or more a month, you can access our bonus episodes, the most recent of which should, in theory, be me and Jack talking about Doctor Strange.
We also have merch. You can find it on TeePublic and Redbubble, and we have links posted on Twitter and in the description of this episode.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, because we live in a cyberpunk nightmare oligopoly.
Totally Trans, Searching for the Trans Canon, is co-hosted by me, Katie Coleman. And you can find me... Should I have gone first? Should you have gone first?
You should have gone first, but for some reason I gave you Henry's thingy.
That's fine. I know I don't write for about film and masculinity and Henry Jardina. Okay, sorry. Totally Trans, Searching for the Trans Canon, is co-hosted by me, Katie Coleman, and you can find me on Twitter at Katie of the Lake.
And co-hosted this week by me, Ada Rhodes Short, who can be found on Twitter at the Ada Rhodes, that is the _ADA_RHODES. All quotes and audio clips are being used under fair use.
I think that use was very fair, don't you?
And our season 3 theme music, season 4 theme music, or I think this is technically season 5 theme music, is an open question, only to be answered by the passage of time, the magic of editing.
We'll put a link in the description to the music.
Until next week, keep searching.
That was...
Yay. That was not my best recording day. I'm so sorry.
That's... Well, you're the one who has to edit it this time, right? So...
Yeah, I'll make it sound nice. We'll all sound pretty and smart.
I love that. That's my two favorite things to sound.
Go ahead, stop.